Order. Can we have roll call?
Chair Carter?
Here.
Vice Chair Hayes?
Here.
Regent Del Carlo?
Here.
Regent Lieberman?
Here.
Regent McMichael?
Here.
Regent Perkins?
Here.
Chair, you have a quorum.
Thank you. Do we have any public comment here in Las Vegas? Or I guess Henderson. Do we have any public comment in Reno?
There's none in Reno.
Any public comment in Elko?
No public comment from Elko.
We'll go on to item number 2, our consent items. Do I have a motion for approval?
So moved.
We have a motion. Do we have a second? A second on the consent items? Anybody? So we have a motion from Regent Lieberman or a second from Trevor Hayes. Any discussion?
I think she had actually seconded over here.
I'm sorry about that. I missed it.
Didn't you say yeah?
All in favor say aye.
Aye.
No, the motion passes. We'll move on to item number 3, change in leadership. Mr. Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury, Chief Internal Auditor. In the audit summary document, I've included a table of the 3 audit reports being presented today, along with the key findings. So as background for new committee members, historically, when there's a change in institution president, we'll perform a change in leadership audit. This typically occurs within the new president's first year, and the idea behind these came really decades ago. And for the sake of the new incoming president, internal audit will do a quick review of some standard areas so that he or she can be assured that things are operating as intended, or we'll have an understanding of any areas that may need some attention. And it makes sense. In previous committee meetings, I've talked about how risk levels inherently increase whenever you see a change in process, in systems, or in people. So these audits historically include expenditures review, that'd be host, operating, or travel, financial account review for deficit balances, review of any legal issues, contracts, equipment, that kind of thing. So with that background in mind, for this audit at CSN, we had just a few findings related to the review of operating host and travel transactions, as well as reviews of deficit account balances and evaluation of some of those related corrective actions. Thank you.
Do I have a motion to accept this audit? Regent Del Carlo, motion. Sam, second. Any discussion? Yes, Regent Perkins.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was wondering, it said a deficit account. Can you explain that to me since I'm not on page 4 of 8?
Is Mary Kay in the crowd?
Is Mary Kay in the crowd from CSN? This would be in relation to the, is that the dental account? Yes.
Mary Kay Bailey, Vice President for Finance and Administration from the College of Southern Nevada. The question is about the deficit account for the dental faculty practice.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Yes.
Yes, the dental faculty practice balance as of when the audit was conducted and as of now actually has a deficit cash balance. And that is a program that the department is looking into. It was actually on the prior agenda for the Business, Finance, and Facilities Committee meeting in the fiscal exception report as well. And so that is something the college has been working on for several months now.
Is that because you inherited some things in the process of opening the dental?
No, the facility has been open for quite some time. It's just a model that is not currently that we're not currently able to sustain. So, without getting into, I can get into a lot of detail if you like, but we're just not able to sustain the current model. So, we have a plan to look into a different model for operating our dental faculty practice and working on partnerships with either our local university or other clinics in the valley.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Any other discussion? So I have a motion to accept from Regent Del Carlo and a second from Regent Lieberman. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. We'll go on to item number 4, purchasing card program WNC. Mr. Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury. Our P-card audits are becoming more sophisticated, and I think the committee will continue to see some useful changes to our deliverables on this front. For these types of audits, more and more we're utilizing data analytics, not only to efficiently identify transactions to test, but to review items much like merchant category codes. Those are codes authorized for use on these purchasing cards. So this quick test identified a number of codes that might be inappropriate or unnecessary. And so upon management's review, this led to the exclusion of a handful of these codes. And it's always good to have that stronger preventative control in place. Additionally, our walkthroughs of various processes led to some suggestions to improve cardholder application and related documentation. Thank you.
Do we have a motion to accept? Regent DiCarlo. Regent DiCarlo, and then do we have a second? Regent Perkins. And Regent DiCarlo, please.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. Chief Auditor, analytics has come up a lot, and it was on the three bids that we had at our last special meeting. And so what exactly do you mean by, what is analytics? Because that's a new term for me.
Sure,
in
thank
this
you.
Regard.
Thank you, Regent DiCarlo. For the record, Joe Sunbury. So when I speak of data analytics, internal audit utilizes a certain software. We use IDEA. And there's several out there. ACL is another common one. But essentially, what it allows us to do, traditional audit approaches tend to be more of sampling techniques, right? So we'd get a giant population, and we'd pick every 50th item, and it would be very, very random, right? And what these software programs allow us to do is essentially, once we're able to get the data and concatenate it in the way that we need to, we're able to essentially really look through the whole population. The software has the ability to identify any anomalies, and we're able to sort of target our selections to say, huh, this one looks a little goofy, or hey, this transaction occurred on a weekend. Why would that happen? You know, and just things that might look a little bit odd, and you can play around with the parameters a little bit. So really what it is it's a way for us to not only get a more depth in what we're testing in a wider population, but we're able to do it a little bit more efficiently and then focus on those transactions that look a little bit odd. So I think that's part of what it is. I hope that makes sense. So.
Any other discussion? I just want to point out on page 5, there we have another case of where we have a transaction for $4,999, and that was split with three different transactions to the same vendor in one day. And seemingly we have that happen a lot, so we need to make sure that control is in place at the institutions and have the correct amount that they're able to charge, because that control, I'm assuming, is in place for some sort of reason, but this happens seemingly a lot on our audits. So we have a motion to accept. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Motion passes. Item 5, hosting and chi.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury, Chief Internal Auditor. Board policy requires internal audit to review a sample of hosting expenditures annually, so the committee tends to see a few of these hosting audits in a given year. This, I believe, may have been the first hosting audit completely done in Workday. So the intent of our various recommendations is to provide users within that new ERP system with improved guidance for documentation and classification purposes. Thinking, are there tools within Workday that can be utilized to help manage these types of transactions and the sometimes complicated documentation that they require? Also, as noted in the responses, system administration created a training guide and provided that to staff last month. I've already had some proactive folks at various institutions reaching out to see if they could get a copy of that. So we'll be recommending that the system office provide that, if applicable, to the institutions as well. Thank you.
Do I have a motion to accept? Regent DiCarlo and seconded by Perkins. Discussion? Regent Hayes.
Yeah, I was just curious. So this was just of NSHE. And there are 55 hosting accounts in NSHE? Yeah?
Thank you, Regent Hayes. I believe that is 55. We selected 55 transactions.
Oh, 55 transactions.
Correct. So that we didn't We just looked at the specific expenditures within the transaction.
I'm sorry.
Not to say that there's 55 hosting accounts.
I'm like, that's a lot of people with hosting
accounts. Correct. No. I appreciate you asking for that clarification.
No, thank you. Okay, because I was going to be on the BFF committee for next time. We didn't know how many that many hosting accounts. Do you have any idea offhand how many host accounts there are?
Not in front of me. I can, if any of my team is watching right now and can ping me that from the work papers, I'd be very appreciative. But I can get that information for you.
Mm-hmm. Any other discussion? For the motion to accept, all in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes. Go on to item 6, audit exemption report. Mr. Sunbury.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunbury. For those new on the committee, this is a report on our activities for the prior 6 months, and we present this twice a year. The format is fairly consistent with what the department has provided long before I arrived. However, based on past committee feedback, we continue to try to improve, add, delete, change as necessary. I think you'll continue to see improvements to this deliverable. I welcome your input. A good example of this, the last time we presented this in September, this document was 183 pages long. We do tend to pack a lot of information into this. So we took a look at what we were presenting, tweaked a few formats, got rid of some duplicative items, and essentially cut the report in half while still giving you the same information. So kudos to my internal auditors who worked on that, yes. So just a few highlights and discussion items. On page 5, there are currently 14 unresolved items at the institutions. So historically, I take this opportunity and try to paint the picture for you, tell you that the prior 6 months we had 31, year over year we had 30, but we actually have added some graphs to show you these trends. So this graph shows you 5 years of history to give you that visual, and you'll see a pretty significant decrease, and that decrease is really a combined effort of enhanced tracking by this committee, as well as hard work by the institutions who we work collaboratively with, and they take the findings very seriously and do a good job to get these recommendations implemented timely. I will direct your attention to page 11, which gives us an institution-by-institution breakdown, and also provides us with a little color coding. And as you can see, we have numbers in the 2- and 3-year-old buckets. The theme in these audits seem to be have an IT component, right? Be it institutions coordinating with SES or perhaps items related to PeopleSoft security or network security audits. And those do tend to take a little bit of time, but, you know, they've been open for a bit. So as luck would have it, and this is a bit of a spoiler alert for my departmental update here in a few minutes, but we do have a new senior IT auditor who started with us yesterday who replaced our longtime IT auditor who retired last year. So one of his first assignments will be to meet with the parties involved, determine the best course of action for these. Has enough time passed where these need to be reviewed again for relevance? Has the landscape changed and these aren't feasible for some reason? Whatever the reason, we'll work with the institutions and SES, make sure we get the documentation that we need to see the numbers in these buckets decrease in the near future. Thank you.
Do we have a motion to accept? So moved by Regent Del Carlo, second by Regent Hayes. Any discussion? I have a little discussion. So there's a lot of agenda items, and I've asked to kind of flush those out. If you look towards like page 49, 50, somewhere down there, you start to see a lot of items that have SCS components, and there's not too many SCS updates in here. So we need to kind of follow up with that on page 51 going into 52 and even further than that. There's a lot of GBC stuff, and it even says not developed at this time due to the status of ongoing security rebuild, or somewhere in here it says no progress. And some of those items are dated 2011. So we just need to go through this audit and see, hey, if this stuff is relevant, then why is it taking, you know, 7, 8, 9 years to get done? Or if it's not relevant, then let's close it out and get appropriate documentation there. So CFO Klinger needs to follow up with SCS and make sure that we get some updates there. I'm looking at page 59 now. It says no progress has been made on this item. Still working on written procedures, and this is 6/16/2011 when that item came forward. So there's a lot of stuff. So my goal here by the end of the next couple meetings is to have this fleshed out. So we shouldn't have anything this old. If it does find that there's something that needs to be done, then we come up with an action plan to do it and move forward. But this stuff that's been lingering for a long time, we just need to figure out what's going on with it. With that, we do have a motion and a second to accept this report. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Motion carries. Item 7, internal audit update.
Thank you, Chair Carter. For the record, Joe Sunberry, Chief Internal Auditor. We introduced this section as a standing item to be able to provide departmental updates and, more importantly, have a placeholder to discuss risk and emerging risks, and I'll use the term persistent risks. In the past, I've used this platform to update the committee on deep dives into financial aid related to the repeat findings. I've walked through internal audits, risk assessment, methodology updates, and I've spoke about work that internal audit was doing related to other board committees. So today's update is a bit of a hybrid between a departmental update and emerging risks. So at the December 19th meeting, special meeting of the Audit and Compliance Committee, the board voted to change the administrative reporting duties of my chief internal auditor position. So while the position still functionally reports to the chair of the Audit and Compliance and Title IX Committee, the administrative line of reporting now also reports to the chair of the Board of Regents. So the catalyst for this direction from the board came from the November 16, 2018 meeting, where the board directed that the chief internal auditor will serve as a clearinghouse for matters requiring his or her investigatory activity and shall report directly to the board. So I'm happy to report that these changes are now reflected in the internal audit charter, and it did add some duties to my position. So among other things, this includes things like investigation issue intake. So I'm in the process of developing and formalizing procedures related to issues that may arise or come across my desk. And my role is to essentially triage and direct to the proper subject matter experts relevant issues or add reviews to my own audit team. The other component is really to track some of these investigations. So regardless of internal audit's participation in a given review, having that tracking mechanism and seeing where things are at in the process and having that formalized is also very important. Once we track that information, we can use that data and start to provide trend lines to the board and to this committee, reporting appropriate information on a regular basis, quantitative data gathered through some kind of incident management mechanism. Things like number of incidences open and closed, number referred to institutions. And then this data is also useful in talking to some of the other audit shops around the country. Those that have started this type of process, what they notice is when they start to see information sort of gathering in a certain place, they know, hey, let's go and do a full-blown audit in that area, right? So, and then the last thing to kind of tie it all together is, you know, my role is to really try to drive some policy recommendations and help close any gaps we identify and then share those best practices and process improvements across the system and use internal audit's platform and unique positioning in the organization to do that. So I share this as background, but I also share to let you know that in just a couple of months, I think we've made some great progress on these types of fronts. And as things have come up, I've worked closely with Board Chief of Staff Dean Gould and the appropriate contacts in the Chancellor's Office and the institutions, and I've really appreciated everyone's proactive approach with all of this. So, thank you.
Any discussion? Any questions for Mr. Sunberry? That was an information-only item, so we'll go on to item 8. I kind of asked for a just kind of cursory overview of Title IX and the application to higher ed, and we'll get a little presentation on that.
Thank you, Regent Carter. Misty Galicia, Director of Compliance. I will indeed give an overview of Title IX. I'll also give a brief report today on the progress made on the annual work plan. But I'll start with Title IX. I also wanted to just acknowledge that this committee's name has changed. So now we are the compliance, excuse me, of course I put compliance first. I meant the Audit, Compliance, and Title IX Committee. And in discussions with our leadership here, you know, I think we would agree that Title IX falls under compliance. But as you all know, we had a committee at the Board of Regents that was dedicated to that topic, and now we're sort of bringing it back over into the compliance committee. And so all of you all, of course, will have the opportunity to ensure that Title IX efforts are being appropriately monitored and actually managed on the campuses. So I want to then start with this overview on Title IX and think about how it impacts higher education. But let me first take you to Paris in 1900, where a young woman in a long dress and a fashionable hat leaned over to take her final shot at the final hole, winning the Olympics with a 9-hole score of 47. Margaret Abbott was the first American woman to win an Olympic event in 1900. Now, fast forward to London, 1948. Another young athlete. This one had ignored her parents' admonitions to act a little bit more like a lady. And instead, she would run barefoot through the streets, through the fields, in a southern town that was, of course, in that era, subject to segregation. However, in 1948, she stooped down to accept the gold medal for her efforts in the long jump. Alice Coachman was the only American woman in the Olympic gold to win an Olympic gold medal in 1948, an American athlete. She was also the first African-American woman to win an Olympic gold medal. So history has shown us that women have a place in athletics. And in 1972, Title IX affirmed what history had already showed us. No person in the United States on the basis of sex shall be excluded from participation in, be denied the benefits of, or be subject to discrimination under any education program or activity receiving federal financial assistance. I wanted to advance the slide, but I don't have a clicker. Thank you. That was magic. Somebody advanced it for me. So the thing about Title IX that I appreciate so much is that initially, if you'll advance to the next slide, you can see that Title IX, the original purpose was to close this gender gap in athletics. And in fact, Title IX has actually been accredited with the exponential growth of women's participation in sports. In high school, the number of girl athletes has increased from 295,000 in 1972 when the legislation was enacted to more than 2.6 million. That's a lot of athletes. And that's just the females. In college, the number has grown from 30,000 to more than 150,000. And in addition, Title IX is credited, this is interesting, with actually decreasing the number of dropout rates of girls from high school, as well as increasing the number of women who pursue higher education and actually complete college degrees. I spend some time on this discussion about athletics, even though I know we all know and understand that that's where Title IX started, because I think sometimes that the advances that occurred because of Title IX get a little overshadowed by Title IX's, what I call the second wind, right? So there's this focus early on and the intention to enhance the ability of women to participate in athletics. If you'll advance the next slide, you'll see that since then, what I call then Title IX's second wind. The original purpose, of course, was to close the gender gap in athletics, but now there has been a new facet to Title IX, which has also been extremely beneficial, of course, to equality. In the 1990s, so 1972 to the 1990s, the focus was, of course, on athletics. And in the 90s, the U.S. Supreme Court issued three decisions interpreting Title IX to require schools to respond appropriately to reports of sexual harassment and sexual violence against students. The reason, the purpose, the rationale was this belief that the sexual harassment of students, including sexual violence, interferes with students' right to receive an education free from discrimination. And in the case, of course, of sexual violence, it's also a crime. So now you see this expansion of the benefit or the coverage of Title IX, not to say that it still doesn't also apply in the world of sports, but now it's been enlarged into this new area. So let's talk a little bit about where the requirements are for Title IX, what the obligations for institutions are. If we could just advance the slides. All right, Regent Perkins, I'm going to read them. Regent Perkins doesn't really think that she needs people to read the slides to her because she can read herself. So the overview of campus responsibilities under Title IX are, of course, to designate a Title IX coordinator, to develop appropriate policies and procedures, to resolve complaints promptly and equitably, to train students, faculty, and administrators. And then if you'll advance the next slide, those are the basic responsibilities. And within those responsibilities, of course, there are best practices, as well as this concept of being proactive, right? Because far better than responding appropriately to a complaint of a crime or of sexual harassment is to prevent it from happening, right? And so best practices are on campuses to do assessments, to have wide dissemination of contact information for your Title IX coordinator, so people know who they can reach out to, wide dissemination of the policies and the procedures that apply, mandatory training for all faculty and staff. And I will say that NSHE has actually taken some role there to provide education and training beyond what the campuses themselves also provide. We, in the past, we've coordinated with a national firm to come in and provide some of that kind of training for our coordinators, for our council, for the regents who want to come, the presidents. And if that is going to continue, certainly you will all be invited. You also need to make sure, in terms of best practices, that you do a regular climate survey. And then make sure that there are updated policies with clear guidance regarding gender equality, the prohibition of sexual harassment and assault, what the reporting mechanisms are, and the process for resolving complaints. And then, very importantly, elements of anti-retaliation. So that's where we are now. So I took you way back to the past. I've given you a glimpse of where we are now. But very important in Title IX in this moment is to get a glimpse of the future. And this is why. As you all may already know, in November of 2018, the U.S. Department of Education, the Federal Register published the U.S. Department of Education's notice of proposed changes to Title IX. They did that in November of 2018. Generally, that opens a 60-day comment period in which people can provide their comments that can help inform the eventual decision-making regarding the regulation. Oddly, although it should have closed in 60 days, it reopened briefly twice, for reasons that I won't bore you with, but the actual last day to comment was February 15th. So what that means, of course, is that we are now in this kind of, we're in this interval where we have a Title IX regulation, and we have a proposed change to Title IX, and then we need to live between the trees, if you want to call it that, because we can anticipate that things will be adopted, and yet we're not quite sure what that final look will be. In the meantime, this committee, our institutions, Title IX coordinators still need to be able to do their job, still need to allocate resources, still need to build a program that addresses this important area. So you, let me just give you a brief overview of what some of the changes are. So these are kind of highlights. Not to get too far in the weeds, but there will be a change. There's a proposed change in the standard of proof from preponderance of the evidence to clear and convincing. So clear and convincing is just below beyond a reasonable doubt, but it is higher than the previous standard of proof, which is a preponderance. So preponderance is kind of like more likely than not. So you can see that the notching up of evidence would now be required for an organization to take action against an alleged perpetrator. The schools also must have actual knowledge now. The proposed change is that they would act if they had actual knowledge versus previously. I think I'm not being very clear. So the change would be to a standard of actual knowledge. So you actually have to know that there was some event that occurred. Versus currently, the standard that that institutions are required to adopt is if you reasonably should have known, right? So you don't have to actually know something happened, but if you should have, then you would under the current regulations, you would be required to press forward to evaluate that. With if the new regulation was adopted, you would have, you could you could, I guess I would say, you could refrain from acting if you reasonably should have known, as long as you don't have actual knowledge. Now, you can't, like, take actions to make sure that you don't know. You know, you can't really kind of backdoor it. But it does change the standard. In addition, the new legislation would change the definition of sexual harassment. And it would define it as sexual assault or unwelcome conduct on the basis of sex that is so severe, so pervasive, and objectively offensive that it denies a person access to the school's education program. Right now, it's much broader. Currently, the definition is unwelcome conduct of a sexual nature. So you say that that current standard that we have right now is broader, and now it'll be narrowed to a more specific focus. This one of the proposed changes also makes a significant difference in terms of how the campuses administer their programs. So currently, the change would be, schools would have to respond to conduct that occurred within its educational program. So if anybody has really spent any time in Title IX on a campus, you realize that programs that the school runs that are not on campus are often come under the purview of Title IX. So things like sororities, fraternities, some of these outlying programs, they're still our institutions still evaluate and address sexual harassment or unlawful sexual harassment that occurs on those campuses. Arguably, this particular change could kind of narrow the scope of responsibility for organizations. So it would be only the conduct within the educational program or activity that was subject to Title IX regulations. And then finally, the last change that I want to bring to your attention would be the new regulations would permit the accused representative, so the person, the accused perpetrator, their representative would be able to cross-examine the accuser in the hearing process so that credibility could be tested. So those would be the proposed changes. We don't really know whether they will be adopted or whether they will not be adopted. I do want to bring to your attention that the Chancellor, during the comment period, did provide comment to on these proposed changes, and I believe you all are aware that letter was presented, and you may even know the contents of the letter. I will tell you, though, that his comments were based on information elicited from the campuses. It's a representative of Title IX coordinators on campuses, what their thoughts were on some of these proposed changes, as well as the comments in the broader world of higher education. And his comments really were, I don't want to repeat something that you all already sort of have at the top of your head. Would you like me to go through them, or?
I'm not familiar, Mr. Chair. If
I did, okay.
Yeah,
I'm not familiar with anybody responding to the comment period on behalf of NSHE. Was anybody else aware of this? I'm looking through my email right now. I don't see.
That was going to be my question: is if any of our institutions or the system office actually commented into the.
This is very surprising, and I think it's something that the board should have taken a position on before anybody from NSHE acted on our behalf. There has been dozens of cases that have overturned everything from elite Ivy League schools to small and large public institutions and their processes for hearing these cases, and I've been asking the Chancellor and legal counsel to look at our processes and make sure we're in compliance. Even taking away the changes that have been proposed by the current administration, under the previous standards, courts have been finding that they are inadequate, that the standards that were there were inadequate. They don't provide due process, no part enough discovery. They allow the Title IX investigator to be the judge, jury, and executioner. I mean, there's a whole lot to it. Before anybody from NSHE responded, that should have come before us. It's very disturbing to me. Maybe we can put it on new business for next time and find out what happened, but that's something we should have weighed in on.
So let me go ahead and give you the time frame and the overview of the response by the Chancellor. I also just want to clarify. So I think what you're really speaking to is this this trend, I would say, in the courts where accused perpetrators have come forward and said, look, my due process was violated, and there were all these negative effects of, you know, this accusation made against me, and so I feel like I deserve or I should have some rights in this space as well. That's what you're talking about, right? That line of cases.
Line? I mean flood of.
Flood of
like
cases.
50-0. Like none of the campuses are winning these cases. I mean, there are cases where the investigator says, all right, you were accused of this, you've done it, I'm not going to tell you what you've accused of, and you're being kicked out of school. I don't even know what our processes are. I would have loved to, before Inshi weighed in on something, that this board looked at what we were weighing in on, and does it comply with, and have had someone from staff analyze what the cases say, tell us what the pitfalls are, and we as a group made this decision. I don't know that any one person should be making that decision for this board.
I appreciate that, and I absolutely can assure you that those conversations will be had. So I appreciate you bringing that to my attention. Let me just follow up on what you were saying. I think the statements that you've made and the observations that you've made, I think that the institutions of higher education have been in a quandary, right, because they have these Title IX requirements that exist as they exist now. And then you have this, I liked how you said it, this flood of cases, 50-0, right? The institutions just can't get it right. They're following Title IX, and yet there's this wave of concern for people who are accused that their opportunity to be heard has not been respected as it should be, right? I mean, I think that's the line of cases, and I think that these changes that are being proposed certainly take into account the current tenor of these court cases, and specifically, I will tell you, if I didn't mention it, one of the changes is that the proposed changes to the regulation would be that schools could no longer use a single investigator mode, but they would have to use a decision maker separate from the Title IX coordinator or the investigator, right? And so that's kind of trying to address some of these things. So legislatively, it appears that some of the points that arose during this line of court cases, administratively will be, or I guess I would say legislatively will be changed, right, because that's the proposal for the change in legislation. And I do appreciate your comment, which is this board, certainly might have some input and some thoughts as well.
I guess I can wait for news, but I would love for this committee at a future meeting to have the Title IX coordinators come in, or at least a representative of them after they've met, tell us what the current processes are. I'd love to hear from the students who are the ones subject to a lot of this, the faculty who could be subject to this, and let's look at what our policies are. I'd love from legal to tell us what some of the case, you know, what the line of cases, as Misty's calling them, what they've shown, and so we can kind of start looking at and be prepared for whether, if there are new regulations promulgated, we can kind of be prepared to react to them and know what is currently happening on our campuses, what are the pitfalls. I know these new proposed regulations have been very controversial. Some folks like the status as is. Some think that these cases show there's somewhere in between. This isn't a decision for me to make. This is a decision for all of us to make with as much information as we have. And I don't have the answers, but I think we together can come up with them.
I'm sorry, Regent DiCarlo, I didn't want to ignore you.
I wholeheartedly agree with Regent Hayes. I became aware of a policy statement that was sent, and my first reaction was, this is the first time I've seen it. Why wasn't the board made aware of this? Why aren't we discussing this? I thought we set policy, and I was told that it was shown to the college presidents, and they signed off on it, but I was really surprised, so that's all I'm going to say, and I think everything he said is right on.
All right. So just to reiterate the timeline, so it was November that the Department of Education opened up for comment. There's a 60-day window in which comments can be made, and so the letter actually went on January 30, 2019, and some of the discussion points included commenting on having live hearings and particularly allowing students through third party to cross-examine the accuser, which potentially can re-traumatize a victim. Also, the more narrow definition of sexual harassment was a talking point. as well as the requirement, the proposed requirement in the new regulation that the universities provide an advisor to a party who doesn't bring their own, as and the talking point there had to do with the fiscal impact of that. So those were the highlights of the discussion initiated by the chancellor. And I guess the point that I wanted to make is right now is an interesting time to be a Title IX coordinator, to be a campus who's required to ensure that there's equal access to education and that sexual harassment and sexual abuse are not barriers that people face because of that. And so we're definitely going to be tracking those changes to find out if they're going to be adopted. And this committee, as you point out, because now Title IX has sort of been brought into this under this umbrella, if these changes are actually adopted by the Department of Education, then it will require revisions to our Title IV. And so you would be seeing the proposed revisions and then for the first reading and then proposed revisions for the final reading. So that is something to look down the road and to anticipate and expect if these changes go into effect. I would say my experience is that it's unlikely that no change will go into effect, right? I can't predict what the changes will be, but likely Title IX will undergo a revision under this administration, and then this committee will be asked to evaluate proposed changes consistent with new legislation.
Regent Hayes?
Just wanted to note for the record that during the period that the comments were available to be made and that they were submitted, that we as a board met a whole four times. There was ample time for this board to have been consulted before any comments were submitted or opinions were submitted on behalf of this board.
Dean Gould, is there a policy where the chancellor has to can issue policy statements on behalf of legislation without having the board weigh in?
Dean Gould, for the record, I'm not aware of any such policy, Chair Carter. I think it's more a matter of practice. If the board is a policy-making board, then it would be logical that the board would be provided an opportunity to review and weigh in before official NCHE comments are made back to propose regulation changes.
Okay. I have a big problem with that letter being sent on behalf of the system when we have not weighed in or talked about it, when we have a committee that specifically is targeted at providing that feedback and information. And in an open hearing for our state, the institutions could have came in and testified, provided their input, and as a board we could have decided what that content should be. So I think that's an issue, and maybe Mr. Sunbury, that may be a potential audit or something that we can look into to see if there are other issues that have been waiting on without our board approval or input. Misty, did you have any other items you wanted to cover into this?
That concludes my comments about Title IX and sort of what the landscape is like and what we can expect down the road. I would be remiss if I didn't also mention that we're making progress on the annual work plan. As you may recall, this committee and ultimately the board adopted the annual compliance work plan, and among the items on that plan were the comprehensive compliance inventory that campuses are very busy doing. I've been visiting with campuses. I have additional visits scheduled, and I look forward to providing you with the product of that very labor-intensive task at future committees.
Regent Carlo.
Thank you, Regent Carter. Just a couple questions, Misty. Mandatory training for all faculty and staff, what does that consist of? Is that once a year? Is that 1 hour? Is it a video you sit and watch? And is it, I'm sure we document it, et cetera?
Yes. So I would be happy to invite information from the Title IX coordinators who take the responsibility for those specific educational experiences. I will tell you that mandatory education is really just that. You do have to evaluate different sectors on your campus, so faculty, for example, students, run-of-the-mill employees like myself. You know, you wear so many hats when you're an educational institution, and you have to hit each one of those targets. And so the training is often kind of targeted for who your group is. So the content of the training, I would say, certainly best practices is to make sure that it's meaningful for the group that you're giving it to. I'm told that, for example, I'll just give you an anecdote. At UNR, the Title IX training for athletes has been tailored not just around the fact that they're athletes, but around their schedules. So the Title IX coordinator actually shows up like at some ungodly hour of the morning because that's when they had the time available, right, or in the evening. And so really trying to make sure that you service each segment of your campus with a meaningful Title IX training is important, right, because it should be a meaningful training, not just check the box. So the answer to your question is the content of the Title IX training is going to be somewhat tailored to whomever the audience is. And, yes, the documentation of it will be retained based on the group that you're working with.
Any other discussion? That was an information-only item, so we'll go on to number 9, new business. Regent McMichael.
Yes, I would like to bring up new business for information on the UNR rifle team disillusionment, and would like to find out if we can reinstate that program.
That probably should be on the main board agenda. Okay. If you can bring that up at new business for the main board agenda, that's probably the group that might be better served to evaluate that.
Okay, and the reason I was bringing it up at this time is because we might have Title IX compliance involvement in this.
Okay, I could understand that. Regent DiCarlo?
I think we should look to having some Title IX training for our entire board, just as we did in January for ethics training, should, you know, for new regents and for all of us, because this is a big deal with the federal government and all of our campuses, and I think we as regents need to know what it's all about better than we know, because I can say that the time I sat on the Cultural and Diversity and Title IX Committee, I don't ever remember talking about Title IX, so this is really the first time I've had any exposure to it. Thank you.
Yeah, we can definitely do that. Regent Hayes?
Mostly what I said earlier, like us to reach out for this to representatives from either past victims or representatives of victims, so we hear their side of Title IX coordinators on campuses, of the attorneys. I want to get a full picture of what is going on and what we do on our campuses currently and how that complies with existing law, with court cases that have come down in recent years, and potential changes to the regulation. I'd just like to get a sense of what's going on.
Fantastic. Sam, Regent Lieberman?
Title IX was sort of a floating topic. It was only in the Cultural Diversity Committee for a few months, and then it was moved to this committee, and I think it needs to find its permanent home, and this may be the place to do it. But as far as cultural diversity, we did a little bit on disability issues and disability rights, but nothing on specifically Title IX.
Okay. Anything else? No, I think this is great. I think as it's over here in our committee, I think we need to get up to speed and make sure it's on our radar and make sure the institutions have feedback and are providing, you know, that information both ways. Item 10, public comment. Do we have any public comment in Elko?
No public comment from Elko.
Any public comment in Reno?
None in Reno.
Any comments in Henderson here? And this meeting is adjourned.